We have heard several people and their interesting explanations about what Master has said. Quite informative and illuminating also. It opens our way of thinking in different dimensions. And let me share my thoughts. The statement of Master above is no different from the advice all religions have given, and there appears to be prima facie no reason to repeat what appears to be fundamentals. However, when we examine it closely, we find that the statement leads to the more fundamental question of what is morality and how it is to be practiced and what is the goal of such moral life. Morality is generally understood as a system of principles that guides us to survive and thrive as individuals. Balance in life is the primary goal or value that morality achieves, with all other values subservient to that. Revered Babaji, in fact, keeps this to be the goal of all human beings should have arrived at. We have had occasions to discuss the topic of balanced existence. The topic of our seminar today deals with the assertion Revered Babaji made that our life should be pregnant with high morals. In his commentary on Ten Commandments, he devotes five commandments, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, exclusively to highlight the importance of the high moral behavior. In fact, in these commandments, he explains his philosophy and also gives keys to understand the natural path by which we can mold ourselves as excellences of his creation. We see in his exposition not just a system of ethical values to be practiced for the good of the individual in and for the society, but means for the development of the individual's conscious unfolding as a holistic part of the cosmic consciousness that is all-pervading. The main thing is to integrate the individual with the cosmic consciousness. Raja Yoga aims at not so much at the individual liberation as the integration of the human mind with the cosmic, so that the world of happiness and universal good evolves. At the outset, in proclaiming his moral philosophy, he states that we should be plain and simple to be identical with nature. The first and foremost expression of morality thus is plainness and simplicity. He puts it straight, saying that simplicity is the very essence of nature. It is a reflection of that which existed in the absolute in a latent state. It promotes growth. It can be aptly described as the quintessence of the ultimate. To be plain and simple means that we have to adopt the same posture as that of the ultimate condition. This fundamental principle of morality for the practicant of the system of Raja Yoga of Revered Babaji is a categorical imperative and not a social requirement. Yad bhavam tad bhavati, as you think, so you become. Those who seek the ultimate goal of life have to follow the commandments, and lapses in this regard would naturally affect our objective. Those who would like to take a lenient view of this, taking shelter under the promise of the Master that if we move one step towards the Master would be coming towards us three steps, would be committing a great mistake, as we do not know the number of steps between us and the Divine. Simplicity and plainness in all aspects of our life have to be followed, in our dress, in our eating, in our talk, walk and demeanor. Since our ultimate condition and goal we strive for is simple and plain, so shall we think and act in order to become simple and plain. But for that we have to be truthful. Revered Babaji said that truth is the refuge of reality. While Om is primarily the auditory aspect and Tat is the existential aspect, Sat or truth is the relative aspect. When we say something as true, we are simultaneously stating something else is not true. In the mantra Om Tat Sat, confining to the aspect of being truthful, differing from the commandment of taking miseries as divine blessings, we find the Master stating that truthfulness really implies the sense of presenting one's own self in its true colors. The commandment of the Master deals with this aspect in a spiritual manner. Since we are concerned with life with high morals, it is necessary to delve into how we lived like that. An article on how to play cricket well that I read long back contained a bit of advice that I value most. He conveyed a universal truth when he wrote that if we promise to bowl a certain number of overs, say 8, at a stretch in a game of cricket, even if that is only practice, we should bowl so many overs and should not drop off in the middle. He wrote, if we are not feeling well to bowl 8 overs at a stretch, then we should commit to bowl less number of overs in the beginning itself. His logic, we can see, is simple. When we are developing habits while training ourselves, we should develop the habits of perseverance and not quitting in the middle. Further, he is asking us to develop a rule, namely, always do what we say, or we should be impeccable with our word. It is obvious to see the link here to truthfulness. Truth of any kind is a commitment to the universe and shall always be protected. Our every word, every thought, every utterance is a commitment to the universe. In a sense, we may see that the universe is conspiring to make every one of our pronouncements come true. It is interesting to remember that the Tadastu Devatas are always roaming all the time, saying Tadastu or be it so. We are forbidden to use foul and bad language, lest it happens. Why should we ever want to turn ourselves into a liar by not following through on our own pronouncement? It is poor morality to promise something and then not deliver. This can be devastating in all aspects of our life, like business, career, family, etc. After all, our reputation is built on our ability to keep our commitments. For example, say we tell our young child that we will read him a bedtime story, but then get engrossed in some movie or some program on TV and brush aside the child when it reminds us on our promise. We have just announced that our words mean nothing. To both the child and the universe, we get counted as one of those who do not keep the promises. In all cases of truthfulness, we should beware of the ego. Whether it is greed, pride, or desire to be liked, or some other ego-driven reason, we may be tempted to inflate our importance by promising something we cannot deliver. This is the ego in action. We might have every intention of delivering it when we make our commitment, but then we realize it might be time-consuming, costly, or inconvenient, so we drop it. Worse, when confronted, we may try to justify our position by reframing our original promise, I did not really mean it, or I meant that only if such and such thing happened, or we blame some third party. Abhyasi should realize this fact as very important, because we know that we make promises to practice as prescribed by the Master and give enough number of excuses and explanations for not following sadhana as prescribed, though it is the simplest of all yoga practices. When we say we shall meditate for 1 hour, we should, and when we commit to purify ourselves, we should do so rather than excusing that we are stuck up in work or on transit, etc. In my initial stages of sadhana, when I was trying to give explanations to my trainer for not doing sadhana regularly, he advised me, never let your mind act as an attorney for your ego. Truthfulness demands to act immediately on the commitment and not postpone action. When we make a commitment, we must follow through and not wait for completion of formalities by others. For we owe ourselves the benefit of keeping the commitments, and naturally we do not like to slow down our own progress while we wait for others to catch up. I have many associates who complain that their spouse do not keep up the commitments to the commandments of the Master. I sometimes point out to them their own lapses and sometimes prayed for both, waiting for others to keep up commitment to implement the commandments cannot be a reason for us to put on holds our commitments and duty. I would like these persons to understand the extent of power that they have placed in the hands of others. It should be remembered that every time we say we are going to do something and do not do, we are announcing loudly to the universe that honoring our commitments is not important for us. That is, being truthful is not our intention. Surely, that is not the way to high morals. If, however, it's the misfortune of someone not to keep up to commitments, it is going to be tough for him to practice sadhana. If one has already built up a track record of making announcements that never come to pass because he has been out of integrity with his words and actions, then when he wants to practice something important, it is going to be difficult. After all, based on the past performance, he has little reason to believe anything will happen. He would hardly practice the meditation, cleaning or prayer with confidence and faith. We owe it to ourselves to strive for greatness by expressing our true inner essence, and that is hard work and commitment. Truthfulness is directly linked to integrity. Our objective is to have our thoughts, words and deeds in perfect synchrony. That is what we may denote by the word integrity. When we do not lie in thought, word or deeds, we act with integrity. This means more than just being honest and moral. Integrity also means being whole and undivided. That is, all our koshas vibrate in a similar fashion when we make a promise or perform a deed. It is a step forward, it's a step toward merging with the oneness, which represents our ultimate goal, enlightenment. When we cultivate the habit of truthfulness so that all our actions and dealings are in consonance with the state of plainness and simplicity, just as it is in nature, we start developing true devotion. Then we start thinking of serving the Master, and remembrance of the Master gets enshrined in the mind. Difficulties and painful experiences are natural to life, and a devoted person, because of the emotional trend underlying in the psyche, converts such states as states of gratitude. Thus we find truthfulness leading steadily to acquisition of the noblest character, namely forbearance and fortitude. This leads to the condition of staying in the sphere of devotion, happiness and joy. After sufficient practice, it becomes our second nature and its glamour and consciousness drops. The power generated by the habit of forbearance helps us a good deal in our pursuit, and we enter the nearmost regions of the center. But this does not happen easily. Dr. KCV puts it, he loves us so much that every opportunity is provided for us to grow. When we ask for strength, he provides us difficulties to make us strong. When we ask for prosperity, he gives us the brain and brawn to work. When we ask for courage, he causes dangers to overcome. When we ask for love, he sends us troubled people to help. When we ask for wisdom, he gives us problems to solve. The way of instruction of the Lord is difficult to understand, but when we understand, the joy of his love has no bounds. The lesson of truth that we learn is very great, and what a loving teacher we have. Truthfulness impregnated with devotion leads to regions nearer the center. When this condition is mature, we get into integral oneness with the Master. This condition further matures into the awareness that all things descend from the origin and deserve to be treated as such. This is the foundation of the mystic assertion that all creation is a great fraternity. Much has been said and written on the value of fraternity, but Master throws much mystic light on this subject while he states, everything emerges by the effect of motion around the center, and all work together unitedly, all connected with the same reality. There is no real separation. Separation is an illusion and unity is the reality. What we realize? When we realize our oneness with all that is in creation, naturally we start loving all beings, sentient and non-sentient. The negative thoughts of enmity, hatred, etc. find no place for recognition. Himsa or injury or any type becomes impossible. Ahimsa gets naturally established in our psyche and the foundations for peace and genuine love gets laid. The word love for God, love like God, is a much misused and abused one. Real love never arises till the illusion of separation is gone. This does not happen until we start loving and living in the one who loves all. While the philosophical understanding and also the experiences during meditation of oneness is there, yet situations in life are such where conflict of interests of persons is there, leading to hatred and even enmity. To accept all situations with equanimity, understanding the nature of love that is always abiding, requires considerable practice of remembrance of the Master. I am remembered of a traveling story. In ancient China, a former horse ran away. That evening the neighbors gathered to commiserate with him, since this was such a bad luck. He said, "We shall see." The next day the horse returned, but brought with it 6 wild horses, and the neighbors came, exclaiming at his good fortune. He said, "We shall see." And then the following day, his son tried to saddle and ride one of the wild horses, was thrown and broke his leg. Again the neighbors came to offer their sympathy for the misfortune. He said, "We shall see." The day after that, conscription officers came to the village to seize young men for the army, but because of the broken leg, the farmer's son was rejected. When the neighbors came to see how fortunately everything had turned out, he said, "We shall see." We have to understand that the yin-yang view of the world is serenely cyclic. Fortune and misfortune, life and death, whether on small scale or vast, come and go everlastingly without beginning or end. And the whole system is protected from monotony by the fact that in just the same way, remembering alternatives with forgetting, that is the good of good and bad. Master, while agreeing with the opinion of almost all religions, unanimously agree that whatever happens is the result of our actions, gives us a deeper understanding of this law. He explains, when we do something by applying our head and heart, we form impressions thereof at the base, which remain there in seed form till they are washed off by the effect of bhogam, the process of undergoing the effects. The bhogam is thus essential and indispensable. As a rule, nature wants to keep everything pure and crystal clear, just as it had originally come down in the beginning. Even the slightest coating wields its luster. This in itself becomes power, assumes a kind of life which we relate with our own karmas or actions. It is because we pose ourselves as the doers. If we act with the awareness, everything in the universe is His, and enjoy that which is justly due to us, without in any way affecting others, no impressions are followed. This, we find, is the most important message of the Isha Upanishad. When doership enters our actions and feelings, sufferings commence. Revered Babaji, while giving an account of the process of arousal of sufferings, does not illustrate the same. He says that the circumstances for the process of bhogam, which may be from internal causes or external, are thus created. The external help comes in the form of suffering caused by the wrongs done by others, against which we, the people, generally poison their thought on account of their own ignorance. This is very improper, because this action, having helped the process of purification, has in fact put you under a sense of obligation. When this is the case, the work done through an external agency, it may be any, has in other words rendered the function of a true friend. This may seem to be an uncommon approach, since this basic philosophy was never taken into account before, for the reason that it came out simply in the form of an advice to take everything as coming from the Lord, so that the feelings of resentment may not arise, and one may not lose nobility of character. That it is not quite evident that anything that comes to us is for our ultimate good. May it be from any medium, fills our heart with delight and promotes in us a sense of gratitude. The philosophy of our master has for its base the center, and God is central to our being. In a lighter vein, I may quote a wit who said, "Without God, our week would be sin day, moron day, tears day, wasted day, Thursday, flight day, and shattered day." Some fun? With the Master or God as central to our being, we always live happily, and that is one of the great virtues. We need to clarify for ourselves whether it is necessary to believe in God so that we are moral. Morality speaks of a system of behavior with regard to standards of right or wrong behavior. The world carries the concepts of moral standards with regard to behavior, two, moral responsibility referring to our conscience, and three, moral identity, or one who is capable of right or wrong action. Morality has become a complicated issue in the multicultural world we live in today, and we need to explore what it really is and how it affects our behavior, our conscience, and our ultimate goal of life. Morality describes the principles that govern our behavior. Without these principles in place, societies cannot survive for long. In today's world, morality is frequently thought of as belonging to a particular religion or point of view, religious point of view. By definition, we see that this is not the case. Everyone adheres to a moral doctrine of some kind. Morality, as it relates to our behavior, is important on three levels. One, to ensure fair play and harmony between individuals, to help make us good people in order to have good society, and three, to keep us in a good relationship with the power that created us. It is obvious that these principles are based on the fundamental truth of fraternity that subsists among all. Based on this definition, it is clear that our beliefs are critical to our moral behavior. However, there is a current notion, "I am not hurting anyone but myself," frequently used to excuse bad personal choices. How can we be good people? We need to be if we persist in making these choices, and how will that result not affect the rest of our society? It is obvious that bad personal choices do hurt others, as in the case of smoking cigarettes of varieties and drinking alcohol. The recent studies state that the most significant predictor of a person's moral behavior may be religious commitment. People who consider themselves very religious were least likely to report deceiving their friends, having extramarital affairs, cheating on their expenses accounts, or even parking illegally. Without belief in a God, the only option that seems to be left is to adhere to moral standards we make up for ourselves. Unless we live in a dictatorial society, we are free to choose our own personal moral code. But where does that freedom come from? The view of many who do not adhere to spiritual values is that morality is the creation of humanity, designed to meet the need of stable societies. All kinds of life are in a process of deciding between life and death, choosing what to do with power and authority, and this ultimately leads to a system of virtues and values. The question is, what happens when our choices conflict with each other? What if something I believe I need in order for my life to continue results in death for you? If we do not have an absolute standard of truth, chaos and conflict will result, as we are all left to our own devices and desires. Morality impacts our everyday decisions, and those choices are directed by our conscience. Again, we must decide for ourselves where the conscience originates. Many people hold to the idea that the conscience is a matter of our hearts, that the concepts of right, wrong and fairness are programmed in each of us. Again, those who do not believe God are left with the only possible conclusion they can come to, that our decisions are based solely on our need to survive. What we call our conscience then would be based on learned behavior. That would be the most undesirable position we can opt for. Though Revered Babaji has not spelled out the ethical code we have to follow, has given us the Ten Commandments, which are fundamentals of spiritual life. He has no rituals to offer, but provides the reason for every injunction of the tradition. For him, conscience is not mind, buddhi, or intellect, or chit, or consciousness, but it is inner essence of being that is beyond all these categories. As has been said above, morality is generally understood as a system of principles that guides us to survive and thrive as individuals. In order to survive, we have necessarily to eat and drink. The misfortune of human life is that even though we are provided with enough, we fight amongst ourselves. If the Hindu principle of enough is followed, there is no conflict, no war. Master used to say, we have been provided enough according to our need and not according to greed. Master in his commandments lays much stress on food, earned through pious and honest means. The philosophy involved in this injunction, Master states, starts from materiality and ends in the final state we have all arrived at. A happy disposition is a state which percolates its effect upon the lower layers and purifies them. This is a state which may aptly be taken as that next to the divine. Fixing our thought on it means taking into account that which is our final goal. In other words, we begin from the point beyond which remains but that alone. This is the warp and woof which has been interwoven by nature herself. Now we fix it up in our thought at the time of taking our food, so that the effect filters down on the substance which is there. When we eat it, the effect taken in by it enters our body and begins to spread all through our veins and arteries. In other words, we have utilized to our best purpose the thing which we take in from outside. The particles and atoms of the body begin to get purified. The impulse of thought created thereby combines with the food and helps to promote our physical and spiritual health. The power of prana being all pervasive, nothing is free from its influence. It is inside the food as well as outside it. Master says, the thing got from nature is very pure because its basis is purity. The thing earned by man can also remain in a pure state when that is got through pure and pious means. The influence thereof will affect the nearest layers and help to purify this human web. This is the reason why sages have laid so much stress upon honest and pious earnings. The Grand Master, Revered Lalaji Maharaj, in his article on our food, gives his version on the importance of pure food. He gives a link to morals by eating in a very polite manner. Stomach is a palace for food. The power of dhyan will improve when the food is purchased with legitimate earnings, and remembrance of God will be hidden if it is eaten in a sorrowful state. If the food is purchased with unlawful earnings, dishonesty and crimes will increase. Food is digested in the stomach, and then it goes to liver for becoming bread, and then it travels throughout the body, and it assumes the essence of animal. If the food is purchased with hard and legitimate earnings, sattvic qualities and devotion to God will improve. If it is eaten in a sorrowful state, the straight path is closed, so that discrimination for sat and asat, right and wrong, is lost, and there will be no knowledge of which work is good and which is bad, which has to be done, which is not to be done. By eating the food which is impure, and prohibited by the Dharma Shastras, dishonesty and crime will increase. He gives us an anecdote of how persons with impious could behave. One day an elderly person was slapped by another person who was going on the road. When the elderly person turned around and looked at that person, he said that the Sufi should know that he slapped him with the order of God. The elderly person said that he knew that it is from God, but God has selected you for this hard-hearted and untimely work. Therefore, he got this work done through you. The person who slapped with the order of God was also a Sufi and a special devotee and an obedient person. But the work which was entrusted to him was very bad. The special work was entrusted to him because he was a Sufi, but his heart was not pure, as he had eaten bad and doubtful food. Because of that, such service was taken by him. Was not Ravan a devotee of Lord Shiva? But his mind was not pure, as his food was earned by oppression, and he got done what kind of works? This shows that the firewood, water and utensils also to be purchased from well-gotten money, and the cook should be a devotee and remembering God and offer food to him. The food must be eaten with respect and care. This is the foundation for manners and morals and contamination. A very important moral characteristic is to share, and sharing food is considered a very pious act. Food should be prepared with pious thoughts, offered to master, and prasada has to be partaken in the company of pious persons. If there were to be a person calling on us at the time of partaking food, he should be respectfully invited to share the food with us. The practice of atithi is to be fully understood and practiced. Verily, he is God. It should be remembered that food not offered to master and not partaken and partaken alone is considered as impious food and poison to spiritual life. Master says that the background of spirituality is a moral courage which arises when one is moral. My revered master used to say, howsoever advanced a person may seem to be, if his moral character is doubtful, he would say that he has not got even a breath of spirituality. And what is spirituality in the true sense? It is that all the faculties may come in harmony for proper use. How does this happen? When a man begins to be away from self, it begins to develop. The basis of yoga has always been right morals and proper behavior. That is why my master Samatha Guru, Mahatma Sri Ramchandraji Maharaj of Fatehgarh, has laid very great stress on this point. He always emphasized on cultivating principled character. The way of life should be pregnant with high morals. If it is not there, a person is not capable of having the fine type of spirituality which is beyond everything and is worth having. We as followers of the finest type of spirituality should strive hard to live in such a manner that we are personifications of the 10 commandments of the Master. May this be the truth. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. I seem to have missed some words which are in the print.